artificial intelligence is going to be like a utility. It's going to be like a new electricity. It's going to scale across everything. It's going to disrupt everything.
I think with the help of computers, soon we're all going to be able to do amazing things we could never have dreamed of being able to do before.
A significant fraction of our workforce is ultimately at risk of being left behind.
Automation, I say again, has always made regular people richer. It has never made regular people poorer.
Now for the main event, arguing for the affirmative. Again, the resolution reads, robotics will soon lead to widespread joblessness, underemployment, and the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few, defended by Martin Ford. Martin, please come to the stage. Arguing for the negative, Anthony Samaroff. Anthony, please come to the stage. Jane, please close the voting. Martin, you've got 15 minutes.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here. I thank you to Gene and the other organizers for putting this together. So for more than a decade now, I've really been focused on the potential implications of technologies, including artificial intelligence and robotics. And I've really come around to the view that we're very likely on the leading edge of a massive disruption. In fact, I've written two books that essentially argue in favor of the resolution that's before us. So I really do think that within 10 to 20 years, it's going to be pretty unambiguous in terms of the impact on employment markets. I also think, as I'll explain later, that there's evidence that this is really beginning to unfold already. And in fact, certainly if you look at the concentration of wealth, I mean, there's a lot of evidence there to see that we're already struggling with that. So I do think this is a real issue that's going to be very important going forward. I want to begin by saying that there are two vantage points at which you can look at this. One is through the lens of technology. You can look at what's happening with artificial intelligence and robotics, the progress that's being made, the problems that are being solved, and where it's likely to lead in the relatively near future. And then the other way to look at it is through the lens of economics, and that primarily, it relates to looking at things like the unemployment rate and productivity figures and so forth. And I think that both of these perspectives are very important. But I want to be very upfront in saying that I'm really someone who comes from a technology background. I look at technology as the primary driver of this, and I think that ultimately it will be technology that resolves this question. This is going to be a question for technology. In other words, if machines and algorithms reach the point where they match or exceed the capability of a large fraction of our workforce to really participate in the economy, to contribute to the economy, to do work that has value, then we're going to have a problem at that point. And I think that, to my mind, that's kind of inevitable. So I guess another way of saying that is that I don't believe that there is any fundamental law of economics that says this can never happen, that we can never have technological unemployment. I don't think there's any economic law that says that the vast majority of our available workforce, say 95% of our workers, are always going to find a productive place in the economy, that they're always going to be contributing to production. I think it's entirely possible that technology will reach a point where many of those people are simply going to be displaced and they won't find a foothold in the future economy, and that's something that we're going to have to adapt to. Now, no one is saying, certainly not me, that all the jobs are going to disappear. I'm not saying that, everything's going to be automated and we're all going to be on the street and doing nothing. What I am saying is that a significant fraction of our workforce is ultimately at risk of being left behind. And really what we're talking about for the foreseeable future are those people who engage in work that is on some level fundamentally routine and repetitive. And perhaps the best word to use to describe this is predictable. In other words, those people who do the kinds of work that if you understand what they've done in the past, you can predict what they're going to do in the future. So in other words, if someone is coming to work and they're facing fundamentally the same kinds of problems again and again, so not necessarily rote repetitive in the sense of standing on an assembly line and doing exactly the same things, but if you're coming to work and you face the same challenges again and again, one way to kind of visualize this, that is to imagine if it's the type of worker where another person could study a detailed record of everything they've done in the past, could that other person, by studying that record, eventually figure out how to do their job? And if the answer is yes, then there's a good chance that eventually you'll have a machine learning algorithm or perhaps a robot that will come along and basically follow that same path and also be able to do that job. So that's a job that's going to be susceptible to automation. And I think if you really think about it, you can see that that's quite a few jobs. There are a lot of people that do work that will fall into that category. Now, there have been a number of attempts to really quantify that, studies that have been done, looked at this and said, you know, exactly how many jobs are susceptible. And most of those studies have come back with pretty scary numbers. They've been usually in the range to 30 to 50% of all of the jobs in the economy have the potential to perhaps be automated maybe within the next 20 years. So that's obviously a lot of jobs. It's not all jobs. It's not even most jobs. But it's a huge fraction of jobs. And if anything like that were to be happen, if that number of people were to essentially be left behind so that there were no opportunities for them and they didn't have the ability to transition into a role that was in there within their capability, that would be a huge problem. It's something that we have to take very seriously. The other thing I want to acknowledge right up front is that this is an issue that has been raised many times in the past. In fact, going all the way back to the Luddite revolts in England 200 years ago, people have worried about machines taking jobs and the specter of technological unemployment. And this is an issue that's come up again and again, and generally, at least in the long term, it's turned out to be a false alarm. In my book, Rise of the Robots, I actually talk about the Triple Revolution Report, which I'm going to guess most of you have probably never heard of, but it was actually a very prominent report. It was put together by a brilliant group of people. It actually included two Nobel laureates on the team that wrote this report. And this report was delivered to the President of the United States, and it argued that the U.S. was on the brink of total economic chaos and upheaval because industrial automation was going to put millions of people out of work. And this report argued that the government needed to take action right away or else there was going to be chaos. Now, that report was given to Lyndon Johnson in 1964, so over 50 years ago. And of course, that didn't really happen. You know, things adjusted and things were okay. So, I mean, it's certainly reasonable to look at the historical record and be skeptical of this because the alarm has been raised so many times in the past. However, the point I will make is that where technology is concerned, this time is always different. That's the entire point of innovation, right? That's what you're trying to do. You're trying to build something new, to create something new, to change the game. That's what technology is all about. If you go back to 1903, when the Wright brothers achieved the first powered flight, at the time that happened, there were very prominent people throughout the world, some of the most famous scientists in the world, who said that what they were about to accomplish was basically impossible. Or at best, people said, maybe they can do it as kind of a science experiment or demonstration, but it'll never amount to anything practical. Obviously, that didn't turn out to be true, but at the time it happened, there was an abundance of evidence to suggest that the skeptics were correct. I mean, if you go, you can go all the way back to the dawn of humanity, right? There was all this data, all this historical evidence saying that people simply don't get into mechanical contraptions and fly through the air. There was every reason to be skeptical, and yet that reality changed in a few seconds. And that's the nature of technology. That's the way it works, and I believe that that is ultimately the way it's going to work with artificial intelligence and with robotics and with the impact that they are going to have on the job market and the economy. And so this time really is going to be different, and it's because that's the way technology works. Now, as we look at the work that has the potential to be impacted, we can start by looking at what we would call blue-collar work. In other words, jobs that are more manipulative, that tend to be held by workers with relatively, you know, lower levels of education. And we can look at, for example, factory jobs. And of course, automation has already had a massive impact there. We've seen huge numbers of jobs in manufacturing disappear already because of automation. And if you look at what's happening in China now, you see millions of jobs evaporating there because of automation. But what's going to happen is that the machines are going to continue to progress. They're going to become more dexterous, more capable, and they're going to begin to encroach on the jobs that remain. It turns out that within these more manipulative type roles, the reason that jobs so far are safe for people and have not yet been automated are qualities like dexterity, visual and spatial perception, mobility, hand-eye coordination. So it's not really about general high-level human intelligence or problem-solving or blue-sky thinking. It's really about the fact that human beings are actually very good biological robots. We're really good at doing this manipulative work. And so far, no one has been able to build a machine that can compete at the same level. But that is gradually going to change. The machines are getting better and better. Just a few months ago, Jeff Bezos said that within a decade, he expected that Amazon would have a robotic hand that would approach or match human dexterity. So once that happens, that's going to be a game changer. So you're going to see that kind of technology begin to impact in factories, in Amazon warehouses, in fast food establishments, in retail environments, and so forth, really across the board. So it's going to have a dramatic impact. And that's really important because if you look at the job creation we've seen in the economy over the past decade, it's been very heavily weighted to those kinds of service sector, lower wage jobs. There's no guarantee that that continues. We can't afford to be complacent about that at all. The technology is going to have a big impact on those jobs. Then the other side of it is that you can look at the more cognitive jobs, the high-skill jobs. Very often these are white-collar jobs. These are the jobs held by university graduates. And here the impact is going to be at least as large. If you've got a job that is fundamentally predictable, where you're sitting in front of a computer, manipulating information in some predictable way, cranking out the same report again and again, doing the same quantitative analysis again and again, writing the same sort of article again and again, if you're a journalist, all of that is already beginning to be heavily impacted. All of those jobs are going to be at risk. There's going to be a big impact there. So this is going to be very broad-based. It's going to impact jobs at all skill levels across the board. It's not going to be something specific where you only hit one area. And I think the fact that it's going to be so broad-based, almost like a utility, artificial intelligence is going to really be like the new electricity. It's going to scale across everything. And that is one of the reasons that I really expect this to have a different outcome, to be very, very disruptive. Now, the second way to sort of look at this is through the lens of economics. And one thing you might look at right away is the fact that we do have right now a very low unemployment rate. We've got an unemployment rate that's below 4%. So can't you just ask, isn't this just kind of absurd? Why are we even worrying about this? I mean, unemployment is very, very low right now by historical terms. Why are we even thinking about the fact that all these jobs are going to disappear? Well, one thing that's really important to keep in mind is that that headline unemployment rate only captures workers who are actively looking for jobs, right? People that are actively looking for jobs. If you go back to 1965 and you look just at prime working age men, so this would be men over the age of 25 and under the age of 55. So generally too old to still be in school, but too young to retire. Men that we expect generally would be in the workforce. In 1965, 97% of those men were either actually in a job or they were actively looking for a job. Now, that number is 89%. So rather than, it's fallen from 97% to 89%. So 11% of those prime working age men right now are completely disenfranchised from the job market. And there are credible estimates that by 2050, that number could grow to a quarter or a third. So up to a third of men could completely out of the job market. Now, imagine that you were an economist in the year 1965. You look out and you see, as you expect, 97% of these men are in the workforce. And someone were to tell you that by 2020, that 3% of men that's not working is going to grow to 11%, and that beyond that, it might grow to a quarter or even a third. It seems reasonable that you might say, hey, that sounds like mass unemployment. So the question you can ask is, you know, we're debating here the impact of this in the future. Is that actually the wrong question? Maybe what we should be asking is if this is actually already happening. Maybe the unemployment is all around us. It's here. We're just not acknowledging it because the statistics that we're looking at are not really capturing it. So I think that there's strong evidence to say that the impact is happening already. So finally, as I wind this up, let me just say that, again, I don't think there is any law of economics that says we can't have technological unemployment. It's entirely possible that what I'm saying here could turn out to be wrong. But if I'm wrong, it will be because I'm making the same mistake that people have made in the past, which is to assume technology is going to arrive and then it doesn't quite get there. If I am wrong, it's not going to be because there's some hard rule of economics saying that this simply can't happen. It's really going to come down to whether or not the technology arrives. And I think there is very strong evidence to say that we're getting very close to the point where this technology is going to be here. And that means that we're going to face a significant issue. I personally believe that this is going to be one of the biggest challenges we face in the coming decades. And I think that we really need to start thinking about it very seriously and what we have to do to adapt to it. So I will stop there. Thank you very much.
Anthony for the negative.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you, Martin. Thank you, Jean. Okay, so if we look closely at the statement that robotics will soon lead to widespread joblessness and the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few, we're being asked to believe a couple of things here. The first is that the threat that we face is completely different from before, like, say, with the agricultural revolution, where 79% of people moved out of farms, and yet what they still found work in the cities, because this time the technology is on the brink of being able to replace almost all human labor. So the resolution says that this is going to happen soon in fairly short order, and that the likely result will be that most people are left jobless and impoverished, while the benefits of automation just go to, you know, the 1% of earners who own the machines. I want to spend quite a lot of time focused on this idea, the idea that automation is only going to benefit the rich and powerful and otherwise dispossess the rest of us, because that's really the critical question. Like, is automation going to be a good thing or a bad thing? But secondly, because short of having a crystal ball, obviously I can't actually prove conclusively that this time isn't going to be different. But that's why in philosophy we always say the burden of proof is on the positive claim, and it's up to Martin to demonstrate with some hard evidence that this time really is different, especially since, you know, people have been claiming this for 250 years. He mentioned the Luddites, and then in 1950s, the philosopher Norbert Wiener warned that cybernetics was going to displace everyone. Nothing happened. Even when the synthesizer was invented, there was genuine concern among musicians' unions. They protested because they thought entire orchestras were going to be replaced by synths. So before we draw the same conclusion, we should ask if there's evidence to say that robotics is, say, replacing jobs faster than in the past. Actually, unemployment fell to a 50-year low in September of 2019. And in his book, Martin said that the number of jobs didn't increase in the US between 2000 and 2010. And that may have been true, but he was looking at the effects of the Great Recession of 2008. So since then, employment in the US has gone up by 20 million to a record high of 159 million. In 2018, the OECD put out a report that only 10% of jobs faced automation risk, as opposed to the 50% that the other paper that Martin mentioned suggested. The World Economic Forum estimated that by 2022, 75 million jobs would be displaced by automation, but 133 million would be gained by it. So why is that? Well, I mean, for example, an unmanned drone isn't really unmanned. The US Air Force says that a small one requires a ground crew of 168, and a big surveillance drone relies on 300 people. And then they collect data, and then that has to be analysed. And there's tens of thousands of them. One US general said the number one manning problem in our Air Force is manning our unmanned platforms. So, I love that quote as well. I'm glad it got a laugh. So, while AI can now be a chess master, chess players working with AI are even more skillful. So I think with the help of computers, soon we're all going to be able to do amazing things we could never have dreamed of being able to do before. And some of us are going to get paid for them, paid for doing those things. So in 2017, the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation released a paper demonstrating that far from experiencing unprecedented technological disruption, occupational churn in the US is at the lowest level in American history, at least as far back as 1850, continuing to say that from 1850 to present, the US economy as a whole has created jobs at a robust rate and unemployment has been low. And the interesting thing is why they say that is. It's because they say that productivity-driven increases in purchasing power for consumers and businesses allows workers and firms to produce more, so wages go up and prices go down, and that in turn creates more jobs and in new and existing occupations. Now, they say there's simply no reason to believe that the dynamic will change just because consumer preferences are far from satisfied. I mean, we all want more stuff, don't we? I know I do. As we say in the economics profession, resources are scarce and human wants are unlimited. So there's always going to be some things that people can do to serve other people. So, but I'm going to suppose that some people, no matter how many of these papers come out, are going to persist in thinking that the economists are woefully naive and too short-sighted to see that we're in the brink of technological disaster. And to their credit, the past doesn't equal the future. Machines used to be created to aid us, like an electric drill or a forklift. Whereas now, we've got these robots. You still need someone to operate a forklift, but you don't need someone to operate a robot. So Martin and I agree on one point. It's that this kind of robot revolution is already happening. Gene told me when he was a young man that he went to the bowling alley and people replaced the pins by hand. That was one of the first robots. And then you got ATM and vending machines. And but the great thing about them is you can get your snacks and money around the clock. They don't have to go to sleep. So if this, but I guess I should say, Martin could be right that this technological revolution does continue to accelerate. But if so, why should it necessarily be a bad thing for the majority of people? Because so far, technology has made us rich. 99% of the people who are considered poor in America have electricity, running water, flush toilets and a refrigerator. These are thought to be necessities. But in the 50s, these things were luxuries. Only 4% of the adult population was able to afford a TV and only 3% a foreign holiday. Life expectancy has gone up by 5 years. We spend less time on housework and chores because we've got hoovers and washing machines and dryers. Work hours declined from 61 per week in 1870 to an average of 38.6 today. We could be heading for a 3-day weekend. Woohoo! And, with that, I certainly want more of those. And with that, you know, all the new jobs in hospitality and hoteliering and, you know, whatever it is that we do with our extra day off. All of this, it's important to stress that all of this was only achieved by advancement in modes of production because machines allow one person to do the work of hundreds. You know, you can move more stuff with a forklift. So this caused upheaval in the short term, to be sure, but it's allowed us the lavish lifestyle that we live today compared to all of history. So is there any reason to believe that if Martin's right and the speed of automation accelerates, that the trend of technology making the average person more wealthy is just going to turn around and go back where it came from and suddenly make us poorer instead? Let's put the accelerator on and run through a thought experiment. So Tesla cracked the automation of trucking. 3.5 million freight jobs just disappear. The estimated savings of this are a staggering $168 billion. Who are those savings going to go to? Well, I mean, Walmart definitely want their share of the savings. So they're really going to press those trucking companies to give them knockdown rates on the delivery of services. But Walmart are also in competition with Amazon and Costco and everyone else who sells us stuff. And those places are also getting cheaper freight. So if they want to stay ahead, they're going to have no choice but to pass those savings on to you and I. So let's just keep the figures simple and say with these drones and AI, productivity doubles. The price of your shopping basket of stuff halves. What are all these people who only have to spend half as much as they do now on their groceries going to do with the rest of their money? What are they going to spend it on? I mean, supposing a toffee nut latte costs $2 in Starbucks instead of $4, people might decide that they're willing to go somewhere with a little more ambience. I mean, I'll happily pay $3 for a toffee nut latte as long as there's someone playing Spanish guitar in the cafe. Admittedly, in 2020, not many cafes can afford to pay a Spanish guitarist. But once the cost of living is halved, then you can pay them a lot less and they'll still be able to get by. And in fact, in the future, plenty of cafes can afford to hire live musicians, especially now that most of the coffee making is automated. So that's just a colourful little illustration. A halving in prices means that a $10 wage becomes a living wage. It's worth $20. That means we're able to afford to pay people to do a bunch of things we can't afford to pay them to do now. We've been told for so long that classroom sizes are too large, that hospital waiting lists are too long, that too many old people languish alone in their houses with no one to take care of them. We're told that we've created all these environmental problems and we need green jobs to save them. To solve them. Well, I mean, clearly that means there's lots of work to be done, and we'd be paying people to do that work if only we could afford to. Well, if Martin's right and automation accelerates, very soon we will be able to afford to. What if your block of apartments was put up by a 3D printer and the price of your rent halved? What are you going to do with I know you live in New York City, right? What are you going to do with the thousands of dollars that you save? Maybe you'll hire someone to cook your meals, iron your clothes, do your shopping for you, or tutor your children in maths, or look after your grandma. I've been learning a language on an app called Duolingo. If my income, my modest income, was worth twice what it is now, I'd just pay someone to tutor me. Some of you learn economics from podcasts. In the future, you might just hire a professional to answer your questions over Skype. I don't have a PhD, so, I come at a knockdown rate. Martin's probably a bit pricier than me. He's a bigger fish. So if your outgoings were halved, what would you do with the extra money? Who would you hire? Because that's where the jobs are. We need automation, especially with an aging population. We're going to need it to bring down the soaring price of healthcare. The AI can take on the busy work and the form filling so doctors can spend more time with their patients. The economist run Murray Rothbard had a thought experiment where he said that the need for human labor will exist until the point where as soon as you imagine a soda, it'll magically appear in your mouth. That would be a fully automated society. Supposing we ever reach a fully automated society, what will people do for work? To ask that question is to miss the fact that the purpose of work is to satisfy people's wants and needs. We could create a million jobs tomorrow by paying 500,000 people to dig a hole and then another 500,000 people to fill it in again, but it wouldn't contribute anything to human well-being. In other words, there's no point in people working jobs just for the sake of it. Let the AI do it. In a fully automated society, everything will be so abundant that no one needs a job. It's just like having a replicator from Star Trek. Once upon a time, buying a garment was a once-in-a-lifetime event. Now the charity shops can't give away all the clothes they get for free. Matches, which you get complimentary in restaurants, used to be expensive to produce. People give away pens. In the society of the future, everything will be so abundant that it will be given away just like a complimentary pen. So if you found a magic lamp with a genie that granted wishes, if it only granted 3 wishes, you'd have to think pretty hard on what you wanted. But what if you had unlimited wishes? That's the replicator from Star Trek. How can anyone be poor in a world full of replicators? So there's a bunch of reasons why you should vote no on the resolution. There's no reason to think that automation will replace all jobs soon, according to the figures. Secondly, automation has always made regular people richer. It's never made them poorer. And even if automation does accelerate in an unprecedented rate, all that means is we're first headed to a 3-day weekend and then eventually a fully automated society with replicators in Star Trek. Earl Grey hot, please, and vote no on the motion. Thank you very much.
Martin, 5 minutes for rebuttal. Yeah.
Thank you. There's a lot to respond there. I'll try to hit a few points. First of all, Anthony, in the beginning, mentioned agriculture, and this is kind of the classic example that people give when they argue against this. It used to be that most people in the United States and other countries worked on farms. Then along came tractors and combine harvesters and all the rest, and basically all that work disappeared, and now the percentage of the workforce engaged in agriculture is between 1% and 2%. So it is true that millions and millions of jobs disappeared. However, that was a very specific technology that hit one sector of the economy, just agriculture. And what happened is that those workers eventually transitioned to other sectors of the economy, first to manufacturing, and then later on to the service sector. And in each of those cases, they went from doing routine work in fields to routine work in factories to routine work in the service sector. So that was a very specific technology. What we're talking about with artificial intelligence and robotics, again, is going to be almost like a utility. It's going to be like electricity, like something that scales across everything, that impacts the entire economy across the board. And, you know, as I explained earlier, that really hits work at all skill levels. So it's much more broad-based. And that's a big part of the reason that I really do think that this time is going to be different. A second point would be that, of course, technology is going to destroy jobs and it will also create jobs. There's no doubt about that. The question is, are those two things going to balance? And I think that there are good reasons to believe that destruction in the future, as this new utility impacts across the board, is going to outweigh the job creation. And then the second issue there is, what about the match between opportunities and workers? You know, jobs are not interchangeable. Not everyone can do every job. People have different talents, different capabilities, different skills, and not all of those things are so easy to learn, right? You may need to do a certain job, you may need to be creative. You may need very good interpersonal skills. You know, can you really take the truck driver who loses a job and put that person in charge of caring for an elderly person? Is that realistic? Maybe not. So there are lots of problems that are going to come as a result of this. And then finally, what I want to say is that Anthony at one point said, I think that I was arguing that automation is a bad thing. And actually, I haven't said that at all. I don't think that automation or artificial intelligence or robotics are bad. In fact, I'm a big proponent of these technologies. I think that that artificial intelligence is, in fact, going to be indispensable in the future. I think that it's going to be one of the primary tools that we need to rely on in order to solve some of the biggest problems that we're going to face in the future. Things like climate change. We're going to need new sources of energy. We're going to need ways to adapt to climate change and so forth. Artificial intelligence is going to make us smarter. It's going to enable us to take on those challenges. And as Anthony pointed out, artificial intelligence and robotics will also make things cheaper, and that will help us to alleviate poverty and so forth. But at the same time, people do need an income. In order to have a market economy, you need people to have money to spend. That money has to come from somewhere. And if a lot of people are completely disenfranchised, or if wages are driven down to such a low rate that people really can't survive, that's going to be a big problem. So I'm not saying that these technologies are a bad thing. What I am saying is we're going to need to adapt to them. We're going to need actual policies that enable us to adapt to this new reality. And I think that one of the best ways to do this, one of the most straightforward ways, is something like a universal basic income, which is, of course, an idea that is now getting a lot of traction. Many of you may have heard of Andrew Yang, who is running on this platform of a basic income. So that's really getting a lot of attention. A lot of people are buying into that, and I think that's a great thing. So technology is good. Automation is good. Artificial intelligence is going to be great, but we can't just sit back and let this unfold and assume it's all going to be okay. I don't think it will be okay. I think this time is different, and we're going to need actual policies to enable us to adapt to this and make sure that we have inclusive prosperity in the future so that we don't leave too many people behind. Thank you.
Thank you again. Okay, well, I think the fallacy here is the market doesn't redistribute the benefits of automation. I think I already tried to explain that with my analogy of why the automation of trucking would need to reflect in lower prices. Martin obviously doesn't think that's sufficient, but I think it illustrates the first stage. As everything has a knock-on effect, we really need to follow a chain of logic. And when people talk about the government coming in, we need policies. Who are these omniscient gods in government and think tanks that actually can predict the future so accurately that they know what policies to implement to help? I mean, for me personally, the idea of a basic income, that's just going to end up in the government. For me, I see a dystopian science fiction novel where the government starts threatening you to take away your basic income if you don't sort out your recycling. And then, you know, if we go into war with Iran, if you don't sign up for the draft, they're going to take away your basic income. That's like one of the scariest ideas in the world, is the government having the control over $12,000 on everyone's purse strings. Andrew Yang might not be tempted to abuse that, but, you know, Lord knows who gets in 4 years later. If it's someone more authoritarian than Trump, then you never know what's going to happen with that. I think I don't think Martin's adequately addressed the point on how falling prices in a gradual cascading way he did mention that a trucker is not going to look after grandma. I should probably address that. That's a good point. You know, maybe a trucker is not going to look after grandma, but the point is that someone is, and the money that you save from trucking being automated is the money that you will pay someone to look after grandma. In the meantime, the AIs people are already learning things through apps. It's going to be easier than ever for the trucker to retrain. And if we were going to put in a policy rather than give everyone a universal basic income, you could give an income for a year to displaced workers. That would be a far more moderate solution to that, rather than risk biasing the entire economy with a basic income. So, yeah, the trucker might not find a job looking after grandma, but he is likely to find a job doing something while the number of hours that we each need to work continues to fall because machines and AI are doing all the lifting for us. As I said, many of us might be working with AI. Martin Ford's, the other Ford, obviously automated the production line and employed more people and doubled their wages and made automobiles affordable to everyone. Now, it's very skilled to make a car from scratch, but it's not very skilled to work on a production line. AI is going to have a similar effect where those people who don't have skills actually working aided by the technology is, are going to be able to do a whole bunch of things that they weren't able to do before. So, but I stress again, that is even in the interim. If the long term is going to a hyper mechanized society, which, you know, if we don't blow ourselves up, it might happen in 1,000 or 2,000 years, or it might happen in 50 years. That's not going to be a bad thing. That's not going to make everyone poor. That's going to be make everyone rich, because we'll have so much stuff coming out the 3D printers, they won't even be able to give it away. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you to both of you. We now get to the question and answer part of the evening. I want to use moderator's prerogative to ask a couple of questions of each of you, and you people can be lining up to ask your questions. I'll be yielding the floor to you very shortly. Anthony, would you address, perhaps you have addressed it, but maybe I'd like to hear from you to address as well, again, Martin's point that not necessarily that even 50% of the jobs are going to be replaced, but if I heard him correctly, you know, 30%, 40%, that is indeed widespread joblessness if that happens. So he said that, but then he's also specifically said that anything that's predictable, but be it brain work or lower level work, predictable work, which he would argue is about easily one third of the work that people do, is going to be replaced by machines. Could you address that concern of his? One third is going to be replaced. Yeah.
Well, again, it's not comparable to the percentage of people who were displaced by the agricultural revolution. What those people do, we don't know yet. There was no such thing as a CAT scan operator before the CAT scan was invented. There was no such thing as a microchip assembler before we could assemble microchips. We needed the machines. So I don't really know what jobs are going to replace the jobs that we do now. But the point is that jobs are not for the sake of jobs. They're for the sake of meeting people's needs and their preferences. The more stuff the robots and AI make, the more wealth there is. You don't have to give people money so that they can go out and buy it, because the price of these goods and services is going to plummet. And, you know, if it gets to the point where people can't afford it at that level, the price just continues to plummet. People will give away the machines that make the products, because what use is holding on to it? So I'm not afraid of automation. In fact, I think that it's necessary for it to see the end of poverty.
Martin, do you want to address that, or do you want to comment at all?
Sure. This thing about falling prices, I don't think it really solves the problem. For one thing, obviously, if you don't have an income, or if your income is extremely low, then even falling prices don't solve the problem, right? If you're unemployed with no income, you still need money to buy the things. The second issue, more broadly than that, is that even if what Anthony says is true, what you're talking about is sustained deflation scaling across the whole economy. You've got essentially what you're saying is that, well, maybe you'll be jobless or maybe your wages will fall to a very low level, but the prices of everything you want are going to fall even more. That's not an optimistic scenario. That's a disaster. I mean, there's no time in history when sustained deflation has been a good thing.
You think it's a disaster, Martin, that if your income falls by 20%, but if prices fall by 70%, you call that a disaster?
Across the whole economy, absolutely.
Really?
I can give you two reasons. Yeah. One is that kind of deflation across the whole economy, no one can pay their debts anymore. So you'll have...
Pay their what?
Debts.
Their debts.
Their debts,
okay.
Right? Debts don't deflate.
Well, what if it happens slowly, the falling? The debts are paid off slowly. Doesn't happen right away.
If your income is falling below what you can service your debt, I mean, that's exactly what happened in 2008, right?
Okay.
The second thing that happens in that scenario mm-hmm. is that no one buys anything because tomorrow it's going to be cheaper.
Is that what happened with computers? They keep falling. They're not bought in price?
Well, across the whole economy, though.
Okay.
I mean, that's
okay. All right. Okay.
Computers, you only buy it every year, right?
I have a question for you. All right. Your comment on that. My question for you is, if there is indeed a three-day weekend, and if there is indeed a huge need, as you said, to take care of granny, the truck driver can't do it, do you see the potential, the real need for things that we can't afford to be affordable if there's an advance in technology? To create jobs that in the sector of entertainment, hospitality, hotels, three-day weekend, taking care of granny. Do you see a lot of jobs potentially created in that in those sectors? I'm sorry, Martin.
I'm sorry. Yes, absolutely, yeah. But probably not enough to solve this problem. And again, you've got that mismatch issue, right? You know, not everyone has got the talent, the personality.
How about for hospitality, hotels, cruise ships, all of that entertainment stuff? Yeah.
Again, I don't think everyone can do it. And I'm very doubtful that they're going to be in a world where all the jobs disappear and wages are falling that we're building all these cruise ships. I mean, why would you think that?
Okay. Question, yeah.
So I think... From what I know, we don't see dramatic economic productivity increases or like dramatic increases in rates of automation currently. Do you agree with that? And if so, do you think that's because it just hasn't happened yet or some other reason?
Is that a question for Martin?
Mostly for Martin.
Okay, Martin is Martin. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there is kind of a paradox with the productivity that's been pointed out before. People used to say that when computers first showed up, there was no evidence of that in the productivity. But then around 1995, we did see a big surge in productivity. So there was a significant delay there, in essence. It took some time for businesses to assimilate that, to figure out how to use computers, and then you saw the productivity surge. I think you'll probably see the same thing with artificial intelligence. Another point would be that we have, over the last decade or two, seen a revolution in technology. But it hasn't primarily been artificial intelligence. It's been the internet. It's been social media. And you can see that there are some aspects of that that would increase productivity, but there are also some that would force it down, right? I mean, who thinks that having Twitter at work increases the productivity of workers? I think it actually certainly decreases them. So there are a lot of things on both sides. But I do think that as artificial intelligence becomes more powerful and is assimilated into business models, that you'll probably begin to see that.
Comment, or do you want to pass?
I'm fine.
Okay. Next question.
Martin, you'd mentioned policy but you only mentioned universal basic income as a solution for this joblessness that you're predicting. Do you have any other ideas on what policies would do that, like retraining? And Anthony, do you see any private market solutions for this joblessness if it does happen?
Martin, you want to check that?
Yeah. I'm skeptical that I think we should absolutely invest in retraining and community colleges and things like that to enable as many people as possible to adapt to this, but I'm skeptical that that solves the problem. I think the problem is bigger than that. So I do think ultimately we probably need something like a basic income, maybe not now, but at some point in the future. There are other proposals out there, like a guarantee of jobs, you know, a government guarantee of jobs. And I think if you're a libertarian, that should really terrify you. Mm. A basic income is way better than having the government create jobs and have a huge bureaucracy to manage all those jobs, right? So I think, honestly, there are a lot of libertarians that support a basic income. And I think, you know, Friedrich Hayek supported a guaranteed minimum income, for example. So I think that from that perspective, it's probably the best overall solution that you can hope for.
Comment?
Well, I agree that the government making the jobs is probably worse than a basic income. But as we like to say in Glasgow, where I'm from, being punched is better than being stabbed. The problem with government making job programs is they just never succeeded in the past. The government doesn't know what the hell to train people at. The only way to get people into these jobs is to actually make it lucrative for businesses to train people. Now, I personally am not going to pay you $15 an hour while I'm training you to get nothing back. And then once you've got the training, you just go work for someone else. So in my opinion, there needs to at least be minimum wage exemptions for a period while staff are being trained. Then you've got all these extra expenses which the government imposes upon employing people, payroll taxes, labor laws in some cases exert extra expense and don't necessarily do the job they're meant to do, mandatory medical contributions, which are tax exempt, so people are paid more and they're overinsured. They're paid more in medical insurance, where actually they might just like the money in their pocket, quite frankly. So the government can get out of the way and make it cheaper for businesses to train people so that those people can find work. And that's the best way to, the market will find out what people should be working at. There's no one omniscient in government to choose that can see forward what to train you in. Thank you.
Next question.
This question is for both of you guys, but I got more of a gist from Anthony, maybe. But what is your worst case scenario for automation?
Anthony, yeah.
I guess, I don't know, the worst case scenario is like the Terminator for automation. I don't really understand the question. I guess the worst case scenario is that some maniac gets an AI or the AI. Like, actually, I think what we should do is we should just ask the AI how to solve the problem, because the AI is obviously going to be so surpassing human intelligence that maybe it can tell us what to do.
Martin, I guess.
Well, in economic terms, putting aside the Terminator, in economic terms, the worst case scenario is that we have widespread joblessness, or we have wages driven to very low levels. And we may well, as people have pointed out, have falling prices for products and services as well. But that's, again, that's deflation. That's a depression. That's what the Great Depression looked like. That's not a good scenario, okay? And because the economy just gets smaller and smaller under that situation, so we really have an economic crisis, a financial crisis, and I think that would be quite disastrous.
Next question.
This question is for Anthony, and I suppose dovetails off the previous one, but it didn't seem to me that you really engaged with the most severe manifestations of the thought experiment. So you're to say, well, if you consider drones right now, the problem is not that we have drones, but we don't have enough people manning those drones. And similarly, truckers may not have jobs, but think about all the money that's going to be saved, and then they can just take that money and give those to other people with other jobs. But, you know, if you could, just struggle with the possibility where none of these jobs exist. So where Amazon's robotic arm really systematically takes over positions that would otherwise not be filled, and there are no other jobs to pay people to do. Secondly, I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on, you know, whether or not there would be some sort of existential identity crisis for people who just don't have work. So instead of a 3-day weekend, suddenly we have a 7-day weekend. What would that do to the morale of society?
Thanks. Those are great questions. Well, I'm sorry that I didn't adequately address the first one because I tried really hard, which was to say that if it gets to that point where there's no jobs because AI and robots can do everything, then the goods and services which those AI and robots produce will be so abundant that they'll be worth nothing. I mean, you know, my laptop is in 30 years, you know, you can't give it away. The second part of your question was compelling. Sorry, could you just remind me of it again? It's harder being up here than you think. The existential thing, that's a great question. Well, that's what, I work in mental health. I'm not just an economics journalist, I'm also a therapist. So these kind of things are really interesting to me, the meditation apps and so forth, what have you. Now, we're at a point where we have existential dread. I agree with you, because we choose who we marry, and you might not marry the right person. We have to choose our job. Your ancestors didn't choose their job. They just did whatever they wanted to do. So at some point, we're going to put the technology, the apps, the AI, and all our technology to work to discover how we can advance human well-being. And I think that is where things are going now, because see, when everyone was poor and they were miserable, they thought they were miserable because they were poor. Now it's the rich people that are miserable. So I'm not obviously not miserable because I'm poor. It must be something to do with me. So that's where we're going, I think, and I hope we are, as a human species. The only business is the business of human well-being, and how do we deal with the human condition. And I think that we're going to see more and more stuff coming out to help us with that in terms of technology. Like, for one example, I saw a few years ago, they were trialing a sort of virtual reality game where they put electrodes on your head and it monitors how relaxed you are. And the more you start as an amoeba and your creature evolves, and the more relaxed you become, the more the creature evolves on the screen. So it's actually using computer software to teach people how to relax. So I'd love to see more and more stuff like that. Maybe the AI will teach you yoga as well, so you don't become a couch potato with all that time you spent in virtual reality.
You want to address that, Martin?
Yeah, I do think that there's a real issue in terms of that existential type crisis. I mean, you can look, for example, at the opioid epidemic we have in the United States. There has been shown to be a correlation between that and joblessness. So this is something we're going to have to struggle with. You know, what people need is not a job per se. What people need is a purpose. They need to feel they're contributing. They need to feel that they're doing something important. They need to feel that if they weren't there, they would be missed. And you know, in modern times, for the most part, for most people, a job is what has provided that. So I can sort of imagine a future where, you know, incomes kind of become decoupled from that sense of purpose. So maybe you won't have a job that provides both the income and the sense of purpose as a package. Maybe you'll get the income from a basic income and you'll be doing other things. Maybe you'll be volunteering in the community or whatever to give you that sense that you're doing something important. But it's absolutely a problem that we're going to have to solve going forward as we face this.
Next question. Yeah.
So with a number of job losses in the past, was it really automation that caused those job losses, or did jobs just move to places with higher performance, lower welfare, and a more efficient government? Can we blame automation for those job losses?
Andrew, you want to mention that?
Did the jobs just go offshore? Well, I guess I wish that those places where they have the sweatshops would have more open markets, so that more companies would go in and bid up the price of wages there, and we could see an even faster reduction in poverty worldwide. I don't know to what extent jobs are going offshore and to what extent they're being affected by automation. But what I do know is that to the extent you have a free market, there's always going to be a drive to pass the savings on to consumers. And eventually, Bangladesh and Indonesia won't be poor countries anymore. They're already going in the right direction. and it'll be great when we see the end of poverty.
Comment, Martin?
Yeah, economists have looked at this, and it's, you know, it's a complex picture, but in general, they found that automation tends to outweigh globalization. However, it's absolutely true that jobs do move offshore, but actually you can look at China, and jobs have moved from the U.S. to China, but now they're being automated in China. You can also look at very low-wage countries like Vietnam or Indonesia, and what you're seeing there is reshoring, where, for example, a shoe factory from being run by Nike or Adidas will be shut down in Indonesia and reshored to the United States or Germany. But then, of course, that factory is almost fully automated. So automation is ultimately going to overwhelm globalization. And you're going to see a return of factories to be in proximity to markets.
Next question. Yeah.
I was just wondering the extent to which you would see, say, if we're talking about the United States in particular, or even on a global scale, Fed monetary policy playing a role either as a preemptive action in superseding robotic takeover of jobs, or accelerating it?
Yeah, I mean, it does tie into the question, if there's monetary expansion, then prices can remain stable and wages can rise. But if they expand the money supply. But do you want to deal with that question, Martin?
Well, I do think that in general, I've talked a lot about deflation, a kind of environment where basically if people don't have money to spend, or if the distribution of income is so concentrated that most people are kind of struggling and only a few people have money to spend, then you've got less demand in the whole economy, right? There's simply less customers out there. And so you've heard economists like Larry Summers talking about what he calls secular stagnation, which is basically where there's not much demand, there aren't productive opportunities, companies sit on money, and that's exactly the kind of scenario where the Fed keeps interest rates very, very low, money kind of sloshes around, it's not getting into productive opportunities and so forth. So I think this all kind of ties in, and that to some extent that is related.
Comment?
Well, companies make stuff to sell that stuff, so they need to look at what people are able to buy and want to buy. And
hold it a little closer to your mouth.
As far as monetary policy is concerned, yeah, I think the printing of money has been a complete disaster. I don't agree with Martin Ford that deflation is a bad thing. This country had deflation for 100 years before we had the Federal Reserve. The price of everything went down by 20% and people got richer. It's just basically the idea that deflation is a bad thing is probably just some propaganda meme to defend the Federal Reserve for all their inflating the currency and handing out the money to the rich and politically connected first. Printing money is punishing people who were responsible and saved, and rewarding people or encouraging people to go into debt. It's disastrous on several fronts.
Next question.
Even if the bulk of low-skilled job displacement is due to automation, a certain amount is also due to outsourcing and low-skill immigration. So given that, would either of you support policies like higher tariffs or stricter immigration laws?
Okay. We're going to have a debate about tariffs. I'm going to be debating Steve Moore of the Trump administration next month on tariffs. I'm not in favor of tariffs. I think Steve is. So maybe we'll just table the tariffs thing. Yeah. And then we did have a debate on immigration. So, guys, I'm not going to ask you to deal with those two excellent questions because the SOA Forum has already addressed them. Next question.
Yeah, so I work at the kind of the intersection of IoT and AI and commercial real estate, and it's sort of tangential to manufacturing. So I've seen the application of this. Really what I'm seeing is the streamlining of lowering of cost of goods sold, increase in product quality, which ultimately gets passed through to the consumer on the purchasing power side. Add in quantum computing in terms of materials discovery, pharmaceuticals discovery, and it seems like it would be a net benefit to society, which gets to the question of lower cost of goods sold, higher quality product ultimately leads to cheaper costs of capital. And with more availability on capital, it allows businesses to hire more and at least sustain or minimize job loss on a macro level. Have you thought at all in terms of cheaper cost of capital and what that means in terms of preventing massive job loss?
You want to address that? Sounds like it's a question for you, Anthony. Cheaper cost of capital brought about by AI.
I think it's good when companies invest in machines and factories to make stuff because the stuff gets cheaper and more abundant. I don't know the degree to which the effect is on capital and to the. I don't have your firsthand expertise. You know, my your knowledge on the ground. My expertise is in economics theories, and I see.
Okay.
I see it as applied in the real world.
Okay. You want to comment, Martin, or you want to finish?
I'll just say that what you said there was a lower cost of capital allows businesses to hire more people. It's not about allowing them to hire more people. It's about do they need those people? Do they want to hire those people? And if, in fact, the cost of capital was lower, they can also invest that in machines. And if the machines are capable of doing more of what the people would be doing, they're going to probably prefer that, right? So it's really a question of the trade-off between technology and workers and what they're each capable of. And as machines get better and better, businesses will choose to invest more in technology.
Next question. Oh, you want to score? You want to comment? All right. Okay. All right. Let me comment.
Just on that point, isn't it better to have 10 factories with 100 people owned by 10 different entrepreneurs than one factory with 1,000 people? Wouldn't that increase competitiveness, also push cost of goods down more, increase economic activity, and again, prevent massive job loss?
You're saying the cheaper cost of capital causes more companies to be formed?
Pension funds, banks will lend in more businesses if they can lend at a lower rate to more businesses, which means you can produce more factories, sure, with more machines, and you have 10 people in a factory instead of 100, but you have 10 factories. It still balances out, it seems.
All right. Do you want to come in?
I mean, that sounds reasonable, but the evidence doesn't suggest that we're moving to a more distributed, sort of balkanized economy in that way. The evidence suggests things are becoming more concentrated, that businesses are getting larger and larger, right? There are a lot of people talking about antitrust issues with the big tech companies and so forth. So,
okay. Well, thank you for your comments. Next question.
Whenever I see articles about AI, it seems like it's always 10 years away or some bit large enough time frame that it's kind of far enough away. But do you have any evidence that this sort of job loss disruption will come that fast? There's a big difference between 50% job loss over 10 years than 50% spread over 50 years.
Do you want to comment on?
Yeah. I mean, as I said, Jeff Bezos just said that within 10 years, they're going to have a robotic hand that can approach human dexterity. We see a revolution in what's called deep learning, the specific sphere of artificial intelligence that's really showing the most progress right now. You've got systems that can outperform radiologists at reading mammograms and finding is there cancer there. So there's definitely very real examples you can give of how this is happening already. And I absolutely expect that that's going to accelerate over the next 10, 20 years.
Comment, Anthony? Comment?
Yeah, I think it'd be wonderful if there's more applications in medicine like radiology, since, healthcare in America is through the roof. And I think you're right, that is the crux of the question. Is this going to happen soon? Technology takes a long time to roll out. Even if we didn't, if we banned inventing anything new tomorrow for 20 years, life on Earth would still be unrecognizable 20 years from now, because we just find new things to do with the technology that we already have. So it does take a long time to roll technology out. You need to get them in production. So I think soon is an important word in the resolution, and I don't see it happening that soon. And it could happen eventually. Yeah.
Next question.
Actually, kind of continuing with that, talking about radiology and kind of more skilled jobs, rather than looking at a simple service person, like a help desk employee or someone like that, being replaced by a virtual assistant, instead of looking at something more skilled, when those employees really leave the workforce, someone that's skilled but kind of that 9-to-5 employee, do you really feel them or find that they'll be able to pick up the skills fast enough to pivot in the industry as it changes, as it kind of grows?
It really depends how free the market is. If it's difficult and expensive to employ people and too expensive to train them, then it's going to make it more difficult. That's all I can say on that issue.
We have time for one more question. This will have to be the last question.
All right, thank you. It's good. It sounds good in theory that the truck drivers who will be displaced can be retrained, community colleges and all, or other routine jobs that would need retraining. In Manhattan, we have BMCC, 25,000 students. The Kingsborough is 10,000 students. You go into the where the truck drivers live, and in the country, there might be 5 community colleges and a whole state. So how do you retrain these people? Where are these teachers going to come from? Or would there be, do you see a resurgence in rural real estate? Is that going to be a good investment?
Well, I just don't think, I think the colleges are completely divorced from the market. Like, how do those teachers and colleges know what to train people in? The best training is on-the-job training. And the only employers know what they need people with, what skills they need their employees to have in order to make money from their employees. So the best, that's all I can say, the best training is on-the-job training, so it needs to be affordable to companies to retrain the truckers. And to the extent that the freer the labor market, the easier it'll be for those truckers to find new work.
Yeah, but it's rural.
We're out of time, I'm afraid, for the Q&A. Martin, if you want to address that particular question, maybe do it in your summation. We're now going to the summation for part of the evening. Martin, take it away for your summation.
So to address that, I think that, again, I'm skeptical of retraining. I think we should do everything we can. Retraining programs were put in place as a result of globalization and offshoring, and generally they were an abject failure. They didn't work very well. So we should do what we can, but it's probably not going to be enough. And that's why I really do think that eventually we're going to need something along the lines of a guaranteed minimum income or a basic income. Maybe not now, not 5 years from now, but within 10 years or so, I think that it's going to become almost inevitable that we're going to have to move in that direction to give people an income so that they can participate in the economy, so they can be consumers, so that we can continue to have a thriving market economy. You've got to have people with money to spend in order to make that happen. So again, I want to emphasize that I do think that there is going to be an impact on employment. I don't think there's any fundamental economic law to say that this can't happen, but I'm not arguing it's a bad thing. I think it's a different thing. I think it's something that we have to adapt to. I think we're going to have to change the rules of our economy. We're going to have to actively make sure that there's a mechanism to distribute purchasing power and income to all the people out there, because right now the mechanism that gets money into the hands of people so that they can spend money and keep driving the economy is jobs. As those jobs erode or those jobs become less effective, the wages fall, we're going to have to figure out something else. And I think that a basic income is very likely the most straightforward way to do that. So again, I think that this is going to be a very broad-based phenomenon. We're going to see an impact across the board at all levels of work. Everything from blue collar, very low level unskilled work, all the way up to radiologists. You know, a radiologist needs an enormous amount of training. You've got to go to university, then you've got to go to medical school, then you need at least 5 years of residency beyond that. So it's an incredible amount of human capital there. But nonetheless, this is a job that can be probably automated in the very near future. So we need to really keep that perspective. This is not something that is only going to impact some small groups of people in the economy, only some types of workers. It's going to be very, very broad-based. It's going to scale across our entire workforce. And I think ultimately it's really going to to demand a solution. And I do think that the kinds of things, for example, I mentioned Andrew Yang earlier, I think that this is a very, very important conversation for us to have. I think that over the next couple of decades, the challenge of making sure that we build an inclusive future in a world where a lot of people are at risk of being left behind is really going to rise to one of our most fundamental challenges. It's going to be almost at the level of something like climate change. And so I think these are very, very important discussions to have. I think that we all need to keep an open mind about this. We need to recognize that the technologies that are being developed now really are different. The thing that I keep emphasizing is that artificial intelligence is going to be like a utility. It's going to be like a new electricity. It's going to scale across everything. It's going to disrupt everything. It's not going to be like what happened with agriculture or what happened with the early days of manufacturing. It's going to be much more broad-based than that. And so we're going to have to view it in a different way. But I do think that if we can adapt to this, if we can finally put policies in place that build an inclusive future for everyone, then it's all good. I'm very optimistic. I think that we can have the kind of scenario that I think Anthony has alluded to, you know, a post-scarcity economy, the Star Trek economy, the world where people have a lot more leisure time, where they have generally a better life. But my main point is that that is not going to happen automatically. I think we're going to need explicit policies to make sure we move in that direction. Thank you very much.
I think it is going to become happen automatically. No, sorry. That's just my Scottish sense of humor. Sometimes I joke when I'm nervous. Okay, so... I feel like that is the function of the market to roll that Star Trek society out. It's the interventions into the market which slow down the process, like the printing of money, like the overregulation, that makes it hard for people and capital to move around. So thank you for your kind attention. Thank you, Martin, for coming out and debating me. Let's look closely at the motion again. Robotics will soon lead to widespread... Sorry. I told you, I'm a joker. I laugh when I'm nervous, right? The Terminator. Robotics will soon lead to widespread joblessness and the concentration of wealth in the hands of the few. Robotics will soon lead to widespread joblessness. As I detailed in my presentation with some papers, some references to papers and things, there's no evidence that this is happening faster in the past. That doesn't mean that it can't start happening faster. It can, but there's no reason to think that this is going to happen soon. So that's an important point. Automation, I say again, has always made regular people richer. It has never made regular people poorer. So I don't see a reason to think that it's going to turn around and go back the way that it came from and suddenly automation is going to make everyone poorer. Even if it replaces millions of workers, it's doing that because to produce things that capitalists are essentially implementing the technology to produce things, to sell them to people. Now, if people don't have the money to buy them, then those products are just going to come down and down and down in price. They don't want them sitting in a warehouse that they have to pay for the maintenance of. So if there's lots and lots of stuff made, then the same way that you get a complimentary box of matches when you go into a nice restaurant today or a hotel lobby, they'll give you an iPad. I don't, you know, if things are that abundant. What are we going to do with all this stuff? The only reason why we have an economy is because goods and services are scarce. If goods and services are hyperabundant because they're created by AI and by machines, then they're essentially worth less. They're essentially, you can give them away. Even if automation does, remember, the motion says soon. Is this going to happen soon? But if it eventually accelerates to this point at an unprecedented rate, all that there's no reason to think that that will concentrate wealth in the hands of the few. It will do what it's always done, which is make luxuries like an automobile, a refrigerator, a computer, a Nokia phone is more powerful than the computer that landed on the moon, that landed the moon lander on the moon. So this acceleration of automation is going to do what it's always done, which is to make products that were once luxuries so abundant that they're available to everyone. So thank you very much, and please vote against the motion, because I've proven it's wrong. So thank you.
Well, thank you to both for a spirited and friendly exchange, which is always the standard that we want to meet at this SOA forum. Jane is opening the voting again, so please cast your final vote. Robotics will soon lead to widespread joblessness, underemployment, and the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few. Yes, no, or still undecided. A couple of announcements. We will be having the debate between William Crystal and Scott Horton on foreign policy on Sunday evening, May 10th. And we switched that from May 11th because we were able to rent a large hall at the New School, 800 seats, for that event. We're already selling big time for it. And Jane issued a bulletin to those who bought tickets for the 11th to tell you that it will be on the evening of the 10th. The Sunday, the 10th, William Crystal and Scott Horton have both agreed to appear on May 10th. But if for any reason you can't make it on the 10th, we will give you a full refund. Again, we've sold hundreds of tickets to that event. William Crystal, as many of you know, is a very prominent person in the field of foreign policy. Scott Horton also has a pretty huge following. So that's Sunday evening, May 10th. We mentioned tariffs. Our next event on Tuesday, February 4th, Heritage Foundation Distinguished Fellow Stephen Moore, also an advisor to the Trump administration, will defend the resolution, President Trump's trade-related initiatives against China deserves broad public support. He will defend the affirmative, and I will be on the negative. With respect to that resolution, guest moderator will be Nick Gillespie. That's our next event on Tuesday, February 4th. On Monday, March 7th, we mentioned antitrust. Columbia Law Professor Tim Wu, author of The Curse of Bigness, will defend the resolution. Antitrust should take the initiative to control the size of the big tech companies against NYU Law Professor Richard Epstein. There will be another sort of SOA forum event in Washington, D.C. That will be on April 3rd, Friday afternoon. It will be sponsored by LibertyCon. LibertyCon will be a weekend event. It's an annual weekend event in Washington, D.C. And I've been invited on Friday afternoon, just prior to the event, so like a warm-up act, to debate the resolution, for capitalism to survive, the U.S. government must take a proactive role in directly addressing the problem of inequality. That resolution will be defended by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Stephen Perlstein, and I will be taking the negative. That's April 3rd. If you go into libertycon.com, you can buy tickets. You'll find there'll be a whole galaxy of people speaking through that weekend on Saturday or Sunday. That includes, I know, John Mackey, includes Catherine Menger Wood of Reason, and I'm now noticing that Jane has the final results. The Tootsie Rolls are out here, gentlemen, because you know that if it's a tie, you both get a Tootsie Roll. If it's a winner, you only one side gets the Tootsie Roll. So we'll see what happens. Okay. You both picked up votes. The yes vote picked up went from 16, nearly 17%, to 19.6%. You picked up 2.6 points for the yes vote. The no vote went from 50 to 69, picked up 19 points. And so apparently the no's have it, apparently Anthony gets the Tootsie Roll. Congratulations to you both. Yeah.